Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and play the new rememberbuilding7.org ad. For those of you who weren't here in the morning, the Building What campaign has changed its name to Remember Building 7, rememberbuilding7.org, where we currently, for the new ad campaign, have $76,000 in donations, and we would love to get to $200,000 so that we can reach Manhattan along with the other boroughs. So anything you guys can do to contribute to that, now you can do it on your smartphones by or on a laptop and go to the website and donate that way, or you can see Manny with a check or cash. Anything will help. So here's the new ad one more time.
I lost my husband.
My son.
My uncle.
My nephew, September 11th, 2001.
Most people don't know a third tower fell that day.
The government says fire brought it down.
The collapse of World Trade Center 7 was primarily due to fires.
I, along with 1,400 other architects and engineers,
have found the government's conclusion to be physically impossible.
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 We need the truth about what happened that day.
Go to rememberbuilding7.org.
Why it fell, why it matters, and what you can do.
And start making your announcement.
Why it matters and what you can do.
Sorry, I'm trying to... Okay, looks like it's paused.
First, I'd like to just remind everyone to put their cell phones on vibrate. I'd also like to start by thanking Dennis McMahon, who was over here. There he is. Who was instrumental in bringing this next panel together, which this presentation on Building 7 has never been done before. And he was instrumental in bringing all these amazing people together. But I'm up here to introduce Dr. William Pepper. Dr. Pepper is an English barrister and American attorney focusing on international human rights. He has worked with and was a friend of Martin Luther King during the last year of Dr. King's life. Martin had read articles on Vietnam where William Pepper had been a journalist and asked to meet with him. Bill showed him from his photo essays in the 1967 Ramparts. When Martin saw that the photos, he wept and asked Bill Pepper to work closely with him as Dr. King turned hard against the war. 9 years after the assassination, family and friends of Dr. King asked Bill Pepper to interrogate James Earl Ray. He did in 1978. And 10 years later, after becoming convinced that Ray was an unknowing patsy, agreed to represent him. Two books and an unscripted television trial later, and having been denied by the Sixth Circuit and then certified by the Supreme Court, Ray died in custody. Bill Pepper continued with a civil trial in Memphis in which he represented the family of Martin Luther King. The trial lasted for 30 days with the questioning of over 70 witnesses, exonerating Ray and setting out how Dr. King was killed. The jury took just 59 minutes to so rule and lay blame on agents of the U.S., state, and local governments. A similar scenario followed as Bill Pepper examined the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. As it turns out, Bill had been the citizen chairman for Robert F. Kennedy's 1963 New York Senate campaign. As his investigation of RFK's assassination progressed, new evidence of Sirhan's actual innocence emerged that was even stronger than the evidence that he had presented in the Martin Luther King case. Bill has now become lead counsel for Sirhan Sirhan. Bill Pepper also convened the Seminar on International Human Rights at Oxford University for 2 years and is currently the expert to the Magistrates Court in Spain on universal jurisdiction, with an opinion before the court urging the prosecution of members of the Bush administration for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and violations of the Torture Convention. Bill has advised a number of 9/11 victim families has admired the efforts and good work of many 9/11 researchers and has long advocated the necessity of an independent investigation in order for the truth to see the light of day. To this end, Bill Pepper played an active role as legal advisor to the NYC Can Ballot Initiative, a 9/11 family member-supported campaign for a new New York City investigation of the 9/11 attacks. With that, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to introduce Dr. William Pepper.
Thank you for that. I have a very minor role here today, and I primarily want to pay tribute and recognize the efforts of the families of victims of 9/11. I want to pay tribute to the New York group that have worked so hard to push this Building 7 campaign forward. Ted Walter and Dennis McMahon and that entire group down there. And I want to compliment and express my appreciation personally to the group here who once again have stirred the pot and caused this important issue to be put into the limelight and brought forward in a very important and forceful way. My role really here is to introduce primary researchers, people who have really done the work on this case. I've not done any research. I've read their work. I've been impressed with all of the work of Graham and Kevin and Tony, and from the outset with the work of David Ray Griffin, who has become a friend. It's these individuals and their effort that are making the difference at this point in time. The task will always be how to survive, how to cause the truth that they espouse over this terrible tragedy to survive all of our passing and not just go into the dustbin of history, but to somehow bring forth a significant proceeding somewhere in this land so that, in fact, the truth can be brought out and given credibility under oath. And that really is the task. And you'll see the importance of it as you see the depth of the work that they've done, which is unknown throughout America, totally unknown. Now, because Damon has mentioned the prosecution in Spain, which has lingered now for so long, I appeared before Judge Garzon, must be now nearly a year ago, Balthazar Garzon, and testified in his court, and he accepted the opinion. And Judge Garzon, as some of you know, no doubt, was the man who went after Pinochet from Spain, tried to have him extradited from the United Kingdom. So he's a man of enormous courage. The United States government under the Obama administration it's done everything it can do to stop the Spanish court from investigating and prosecuting individuals who were responsible for the torture and the criminal acts against 7 Spanish nationals. On that basis, Spain does have jurisdiction. The Spanish High Court has agreed. Unfortunately, Judge Garzon was taken off the case. All of the pressures, the political pressures, permeated the Supreme Court. They found a reason to lay charges against him, and so he has been removed from that case. But Pablo Ruiz, a much less publicly known judge, but an independent magistrate under the civil code system, an independent magistrate is not politically accountable to anyone. And he has decided to go forward, and he is going to investigate this crime. He's starting with a subpoena to be issued to Jeffrey Miller, who was, in, as you know, was in charge of Guantanamo, which was an aftermath of 9/11. And that would be the tip of the iceberg. From there, the investigation will proceed in a timely fashion. So, this 9/11 catastrophe, and I see from the banner down there, certainly was the most earth-shaking, outstanding event of our time. When you look at the other areas of criminality by public officials and by the state, going back in our history, very far back in our history, this one stands out and stands alone for the power and the effect that it had, not only upon this republic, but upon the entire world. Everything changed after 9/11. In my view, and I think the view of many, this republic became a rogue state after 9/11. There were no rule of law anymore. There were no boundaries what they could do. They could kidnap. They could torture. They could kill. They could use extraordinary rendition to pick people up off a street and have them sent to Egypt or Syria or Morocco. Oh yes, or even to Eastern Europe, where the torturing would be done by surrogates. They would engage in two wars. One, as you know, had nothing to do whatsoever with 9/11. That was the illegal war against Iraq. The second one in Afghanistan had the portent of having something to do, because forces that we had supported, trained, armed, financed, decided that they were going to take control of their country and espouse a degree of fundamental Islam that was unpalatable. So there was no stopping the stretch of the republic as it became a rogue state. And everyone in this room, everyone in every citizen was susceptible. You're susceptible to being even ordered to be killed, as you know. President Obama has given those instructions for the first time, even though Americans and American officials and intelligence agencies have done this forever. Now it has become an official part of American policy. So what we're up against here, and the rock that's being pushed up this enormous hill, is a major challenge of our lifetime, and must be the challenge that we continue in the interests of our children and grandchildren. So there's no mistake about it. The work that people like Graham, Kevin, and Tony are doing has to go on. It has to be absorbed, and it has to permeate the entirety of this land. I tend to find more receptivity in Europe than I do in the United States about the truth of this. Maybe because the Europeans tend to be over the centuries much more politically skeptical and suspicious of their rulers. But nevertheless, they're there. European public officials have spoken out. European intelligence officials have spoken out at various times and relayed a truth. A major problem here with respect to the work of these good researchers and yourselves, indeed all of us, is the control of mainstream media. The control of the corporate media is virtually complete at this point in time, and it's very, very difficult to overcome that control. Sadly, even the left has its own gatekeepers, and those gatekeepers on the left are also well known to those of you who've tried to get this story told. So it's not going to be an easy task to overcome the dark night of silence that that surrounds this issue. The threats that go to individuals who were eyewitnesses, who did see things, and who are afraid of the loss of their pensions or even their lives or the lives of their families. So it's not going to be an easy struggle, and I just simply applaud again all of you who continue it and are willing to continue to wage this struggle. Now here today, we're going to hear the work of critical work of three people, and we're going to look at it when they finish speaking in terms of what could be presented, actually could be presented possibly in a court of law, so that if one takes the combined works and research and scholarship and of these people to a prosecutor, to a district attorney somewhere, one could argue convincingly that, look, this is hard evidence. This would be admissible before a grand jury. And we're going to take that kind of legalistic look. Admittedly, it'll be in summary fashion, but we're going to take that kind of legalistic look at some of the work to see what actually has gone on and what could be brought there. I believe at some point in time, with an adequate record, it's compiled, and this may have to be done through a civil action that, in my view, is a very carefully planned civil action, not the one that happened in Washington that my dear friends at Motley Rice brought, but another very carefully studied civil action, and so that there is a record under oath that has the credibility that contains the work of these people. And that's what I think we'll have to do. When that is done, and that will be done eventually, it's a question always of money in these kinds of cases. When that is done, I find it hard to believe that there will not be available in some corner of this republic, some prosecutor, some local district attorney from northern Vermont or western New Hampshire or somewhere like that, who will say, I'm going to run with this. I've had victims in my jurisdiction. I have families who live here who have lost family members, and I'm convinced and I'm going to run with this. And it will only take, in my view, one such prosecutor with that kind of courage. And frankly, I think ultimately we're going to find him, but we have to stay the course until then, and that's what I'm asking you all to do. So let's keep that in mind. And with that in mind, let me begin this list of witnesses with Graham McQueen. Graham is going to be discussing the foreknowledge of the World Trade Center's collapse, the challenge of the official hypothesis, and which, as you know, was a 47-story building, that steel-structured building that was felled by fire. When I read Judge Heseltine's comment on that, it was incredible. But nevertheless, they continually try to assert what is convenient. Graham received his PhD in comparative religion from Harvard University, taught in the religious studies program and department at McMaster University in Canada for 30 years. In 1989, he became the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster, after which he helped develop the BA program in Peace Studies and co-directed peace-building projects in Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. He has also contributed to the development of the Women's Peace Brigade in North India, active now in several states, and was involved for some years in the Third Option, a peace initiative for Afghanistan. He has published numerous peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, as well as four books. He took early retirement from McMaster University to devote his energy to peace and justice work. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Graham McQueen.
Thank you, Mr. Pepper. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to join this fascinating day's activities. It's a great honor to share the podium with so many wonderful speakers and individuals. Also an honor to be introduced by William Pepper. As I said to Kevin the other day, this is the world turned upside down, since, of course, I should be introducing him. My topic today is foreknowledge of World Trade Center 7's collapse, but I was asked to say a couple of words first about the building in general. I think most of you know this, but it won't hurt to go through it. I won't spend too much time, just to locate you in the right spot. We are, after all, talking about a specific building today and the collapse of that building. It is an important collapse, not just to architects and engineers. In terms of political history, I would say this is probably one of the most important building collapses in modern history, certainly worth our day's study. So here's where it's located. This picture is taken obviously from the air and somewhat to the south. The tall building closest to you is World Trade 2, the South Tower. Then World Trade 1, the North Tower, with the big aerial on top. And then across Vesey Street is our building, World Trade 7. It was about 350 feet from the north side of the North Tower. Here's a shot from the north, South Tower in the distance, then the North Tower, and then our building, World Trade 7. 7 was 47 stories high, as you've heard, 650 feet, a big building by the standards of most of us from the towns and cities that most of us come from. Each floor was had about the same area as a football field, so it was a large building. This building was not struck by a plane. It did suffer some damage when the North Tower came down. Here you see this enormous steel structure called the North Tower, which has been reduced to a rapidly moving cloud of pulverized material, and 7 is standing in the midst of it. It also suffered fires on the day, which you can see here. And just before 5:21 in the afternoon, there was a little tremor of the earth, which registered as a seismic signal, and 10 seconds later, the building came down. And you've seen it before, this collapse. You'll probably see it many times today, but it's definitely worth looking at more than once. Ten seconds after, the earth shook. Now, it took the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce, quite a few years to come up with its final report. But finally, in 2008, they came up with their final report on the collapse of this building. Insofar as we can talk about an official story about the collapse of World Trade 7, it would be the story found in this report. So you'll find us, the three speakers this afternoon, all referring to this report. We'll call the National Institute of Standards and Technology NIST, because it's easier to say. And we'll be talking about this particular report when we refer to the NIST report. The gist, as William Pepper just said, the gist of their conclusion is that this building came down in the way that you just observed because of office fires. Many, many people reject that explanation, including all the speakers today. That is, all the speakers, certainly, this afternoon. Many of us think that this building came down because it was intentionally and skillfully brought down on 9/11. In other words, it was subjected to a controlled demolition. I imagine most of you here have heard this claim before. Some of you may still find it outrageous. The implications of it if we're right, are of course huge. We would then have to say, why have we all been lied to for 9.5 years? We would have to ask, what else may have gone on that day that we don't know about? How about those other buildings that collapsed? What about 9/11 as a whole? What about the global war on terror? Now, we're not going to explore those wide, wide, important questions today. We're going to focus on 7, Building 7. But I did want to mention them to you, because that's the context in which we study this building, and that's why it's one of the most important building collapses in modern history. Now, that's my little intro to Building 7, and I now want to move into my specific topic. And to do that, I am going to begin by showing you the way Building 7's collapse was dealt with by the BBC. If we can turn the sound up for this one, it's sometimes a bit quiet.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago, I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Centers, of just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. But this isn't the first building that has suffered as a result. We know that part of the Marriott Hotel next to the World Trade Center also collapsed as a result of this huge amount of falling debris from 110 floors of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still.
We'll cut off Jane Stanley there. Jane Stanley talks for about 7 minutes altogether. After 7 minutes, her image breaks up and the anchor says, unfortunately, I think we've lost the line with Jane Stanley. In the meantime, however, we have those remarkable 7 minutes. Two things I want to note. First of all, the red arrow shows you the caption at the bottom, which confirms what she's saying, the 47-story Salomon Brothers building. That's another name for World Trade 7. Close to the World Trade Center has also collapsed. And of course, the second thing that's worth noting is that the building is standing behind her the entire time she's speaking. World Trade Center 7 has not collapsed, nor is it collapsing, nor will it collapse till over 20 minutes after its collapse was announced. Now, when this little video clip from the BBC was rediscovered and posted on the internet in 2007, it raised a lot of controversy. Firestorm of debate and dialogue, and the BBC received many letters of complaint and query, to which finally they felt an obligation to respond. So the head of news for BBC World said the following: we're not part of a conspiracy. Nobody told us what to say or do on September the 11th. We didn't get told in advance that buildings were going to fall down. If we reported the building had collapsed before it had done so, it would have been an error, no more than that. Well, perhaps your laughter indicates that I don't need to analyze that too much more, but I will anyway, because that's what academics do. They go on and on, you know, even when it's not necessary. They flog dead horses. So let's just examine, let's just think about that claim. It was just an error and nothing more. Suppose one of the organizers of this event were to pop up right now and say, Unfortunately, Graham McQueen fell and hurt his knee on the way here today, and that's why he's just collapsed and died. Hopefully, some of you would point out that I haven't collapsed and died. I'm here. Well, then we would have to ask, what kind of a peculiar situation was that? What do we make of that announcement? Now, so far, we probably would agree that it was an error, albeit a bizarre error. It's a bizarre error, not only because I'm still standing, but because hurting your knee doesn't normally lead to you collapsing and dying. Nonetheless, we might pass it off, but supposing 20 minutes later I did collapse and die at the podium, then the situation has completely changed, hasn't it? Now, we still have error. There was an error in the timing of the announcement. But we also have tremendous accuracy. We have truth being communicated. And when I say tremendous accuracy, that's because my collapsing and dying could not apparently have been predicted through what happened to me. You see the point? If you were a police investigator trying to figure out why I'd collapsed and died, don't you think you'd have some pretty tough questions for that person who popped up and said I had already collapsed and died? Now, some of you may think it's a bad analogy because, after all, people don't normally die when they hurt their knee, whereas this building was clearly on fire, and surely that's a more natural thing to expect its collapse. But it isn't. You've been told this before, but I'm going to say it again. This direct quotation from the NIST report, you should paste on your foreheads. It's so important. This was the first known instance of the total collapse of a tall building primarily due to fires. We could put it more powerfully. This is the first time in history that a building like this has come down from fires. This is a unique, unprecedented, and therefore unpredictable event. So if it was fishy to somehow think I was going to collapse and die because I'd hurt my knee, it was even fishier to expect that this building would come down simply because it was on fire. Now, I want to stop and make a little distinction here. It may be a bit pedantic and unnecessary, but I want to take my time with this. If you were that police investigator looking into my death, you would be asking tough questions, because at some point you would understand the difference between two types of foreknowledge. One we might call evidence-based foreknowledge, and the other we might call action-based foreknowledge. Evidence-based foreknowledge is when you see something, you observe something, study it, measure it, whatever, and you find evidence that rationally leads you to conclude that something for sure is going to happen. You gain your foreknowledge through the study of the evidence. Action-based foreknowledge is when you know something's going to happen because you're darn well going to make it happen. It's the human will and human action that brings it about. Now, that's quite a common form of foreknowledge. We know about things that are going to happen in the future because we're going to do them, or people we know are going to do them. There's nothing inherently fishy about it, but it becomes fishy when we pretend it's something else. So the investigator, looking into my death, would consider the possibility that the person that said I had already collapsed was maybe an extremely skilled physician, good at prognosis, sees all the signs, knows I'm going to die, and just jumps the gun a little. That would be a legitimate evidence-based foreknowledge. But the investigator will also consider the possibility that perhaps the person who talked about me collapsing had poisoned my coffee that morning. In other words, had done something which led them to know that that was going to happen. Excuse me for having to kind of go through these distinctions, but they're important, because my main contention, my argument, is that NIST has tried again and again and again, first of all, to ignore the foreknowledge of Building 7, but when it finds itself unable to avoid the topic, it tries to present it all as prognosis, as the evidence-based estimation that something is going to happen, whereas I'm claiming it can't be. The evidence is such that that cannot be true, that what is true is that it's action-based foreknowledge. People knew that building was coming down because somebody had determined to bring it down. That's my argument. Now, of course, you would expect those tough questions that were asked of the person who predicted my death to be asked of the BBC. Did the FBI or the 9/11 Commission or NIST ask tough questions of the BBC? As far as we know, they did not. As far as I know, they did not ask tough questions of any of the individuals or groups or agencies that had foreknowledge of the collapse of World Trade 7. And that tells you something about the quality of the investigation. Now, I'd like to back up for a moment and start defining a couple of terms. I've talked about foreknowledge, but I haven't told you what it is. And it turns out that this is quite important to what I want to say today. I'm taking a standard definition of foreknowledge from Merriam-Webster's Third International Dictionary. Foreknowledge is knowledge of a thing before it happens or exists. Knowledge, it's a form of knowledge. And I'm going to try and distinguish this from other kinds of awareness that we have of the future, because we all live in some degree of awareness of our futures and our past. And we have a broad array of terms that we use when we talk about our awareness of the future. Prediction, forecast, prescience, hunch, all kinds of terms that we use. But foreknowledge is a very specific term and a very specific concept. And I'm going to suggest to you that there are three major elements that are crucial if we're going to use the term foreknowledge. Certainty, confirmation, and detail. Certainty is a state of the knower, of the person doing the knowing, how you feel. You feel certain. You feel confident, free from doubt or uncertainty. Confirmation is not a quality of the knower, but of the events in the world. The thing that you think is going to happen has to happen. Otherwise, we don't call it knowledge. You could be convinced something is going to happen, you could be certain, but if it doesn't happen, we don't call it knowledge and we don't call it foreknowledge. And finally, detail. Maybe that one's a little trickier, so let me pause on that. If someone were to say, I know that I'm going to die someday, they're speaking in certainty. Undoubtedly, what they say will be confirmed in time, but we don't normally call that foreknowledge. It's awareness of a general truth that human beings are mortal, but it shows no specific knowledge of your particular, of that person's particular life and death. There must be sufficient detail present in which to convince us this is what we want to call foreknowledge. So if the person says, I know that I'm going to die in March 2015, and if in fact they do, we'll call that foreknowledge. And then, of course, we would be forced to ask what kind of foreknowledge it was, evidence-based, action-based, or whatever. You see the distinction. Now, the reason this is important is because I'm going to systematically go through all three of these criteria in order to argue that there was, in fact, foreknowledge, not just hunches and the rest of it, because NIST will try and make this just as vague as they possibly can. And that's why I want to make it clear. I want to show that there was widespread foreknowledge of World Trade 7's collapse. We'll blank that screen for a moment because I want to discuss some textual evidence at this point. A couple of years ago, I went through the oral histories of the New York firefighters. Actually, this was the second time I'd gone through them. There's about 10,000 pages of primary source, extremely valuable documents here. I wanted to see what kind of awareness there was among the firefighters of World Trade 7. And of the 60 firefighters I found who had some clear awareness that it was going to come down. I asked the question, was there uncertainty or certainty? You find both. You find firefighters who say the chiefs were concerned about Building 7, or they thought it might come down. But you also find a really surprising degree of certainty. And so in exploring this first term, this first concept of certainty, I thought it would be worth looking at that material. And slightly over half of the firefighters expressed certainty that they had been told that Building 7 was definitely coming down. Some had been told half an hour before it came down, some an hour before it came down, sometimes 2 hours, and sometimes even 4 hours before it came down. They were told it was definitely coming down. And I thought that was quite extraordinary, especially given the uniqueness of this event. There's another way to approach this topic of certainty. Let me go back to the little analogy of me at the podium. Supposing while I'm talking here, some guys file in, and they're looking bored, and they're looking at their watches, and not listening to me. You walk over to them, you say, what are you doing? And they say, we're just waiting for McQueen to collapse and die, because we've got some things we have to do backstage here. And, you know, we're just waiting for him to get on with it. That would show a high degree of certainty that I was, in fact, going to collapse and die. Now, why am I bringing up that silly analogy? Well, I'm going to quote you from the testimony of the New York firefighters. Firefighter Burke: the rest of the day we were unloading trucks. We were just doing whatever little things we could do, but they were waiting for 7 World Trade Center to fall. Donato: we came around, I think we took Murray Street down the west side, and we stopped the rig and pulled over to the side. We all got out of the rig. We were standing, waiting for 7 to come down. We were there quite a while, a couple of hours. Wallace: they were saying Building 7 was going to collapse. So we regrouped and went back to our rig. We went to the building 4, Building 3, I don't know. We were going to set up our tower ladder, but they said no good because Building 7 is coming down. So we waited for Building 7 to come down. Fortis: they pulled everyone back. Everyone stood there, and we actually just waited and just waited and waited until it went down. Firefighter Massa: I remember later on in the day, as we were waiting for 7 to come down, they kept backing us up Vesey, almost like a full block. The whole time while we were waiting, there were hours that went by. Firefighter Pilla: we walked back. We didn't go any further because building number 7 was coming down. That was another problem, to wait for building 7 to come down. Strobel: they had figured, they knew that building was going to come down. It was just a question of time. And everybody was awaiting that. Sweeney: once they got us back together and organized, they sent us back down to Vesey, where we stood and waited for 7 World Trade Center to come down. I'm almost done. 2 more. Chief McCarthy: so when I get to the command post, they had just a flood of guys standing around there. They were just waiting for 7 to come down. And lastly, Assistant Commissioner Drury: I must have lingered there. There were hundreds of firefighters. They were waiting for 7 World Trade Center to come down. I think even if all we had were those 10 little testimonies, we'd be able to say, oh yeah, people knew it was going to come down. The criterion of certainty has been met. Hundreds of people were standing around. Some of them were there all afternoon, waiting. Not waiting to see if it would come down, waiting for it to come down. And lastly, if you have any doubts still on this issue of certainty, how about firefighter Long? They were just adamant about 7 coming down immediately. I think we probably get out of the rubble. He's talking about the rubble of World Trade 1. And 18 minutes later is when 7 came down. Or Kennedy: the only guy I remember that really stands out in my mind is Chief Visconti on the radio. I remember him screaming about seven, number seven. They wanted everybody away from seven because seven was definitely going to collapse. And finally, Cassidy, building seven was an imminent collapse. They blew the horns. They said, everyone clear the area. I think you get the point. This was not a hunch. This was not people having a concern that the building might come down. This was hundreds of people standing around waiting for what they had been told was definitely going to happen. That fits the criterion of certainty. The next criterion that I raised for you when talking about foreknowledge was confirmation, and that's an easy one. Yes, their confidence was warranted. It was confirmed. It came down at 5:21 in the afternoon. Which brings us to my third criterion, which is detail. 2 points I want to make here. One has to do with the nature of the collapse, and the second has to do with detail about time. You know, several firefighters, when you read their accounts, say things like, you know, they mainly say this, by the way, about the towers. We could see these towers were really hurt, you know, and I expected there might be a collapse. But by that, I meant a partial collapse. None of us ever dreamt the entire building would collapse. Okay? But in the case of World Trade 7, which had not even been damaged the way the towers had been damaged, it appears that people were standing around waiting for a total collapse. There's very little surprise amongst most of the firefighters when it eventually comes down. That's the kind of collapse, total collapse, they had been led to expect. In light of that, a collapse zone had been established around World Trade 7. And listen to this fascinating interview to get a sense of how precise that collapse zone was. This is DaCosta Wright. The interviewer would be an FDNY authority, chief of some kind, asks the question, were you there when Building 7 came down in the afternoon? Answer, yes. You were still there? Yes. So basically they measured out how far the building was going to come so we knew exactly where we could stand. Question, so they just put you in a safe area, safe enough for when that building came down? Answer, 5 blocks. 5 blocks away, we still could see exactly right on point. The cloud stopped just there. Well, that shows to me considerable precision. This meets the criterion of detail in terms of knowledge of the kind of collapse, the nature of the collapse. And finally, how about detail when it comes to time? We've already seen some accounts of this. The BBC gets the time right within about 20 minutes. That's actually staggeringly close when you consider how unique this collapse was. To come within 20 minutes is really quite precise. We also had the reference a moment ago to somebody who said, they told us it was going to collapse and 18 minutes later it did. But you know what? I think we can even get more precise than that. I'm going to take you now to CNN to show you how they reported this important building collapse. We may have to turn this one up a little bit too. Where are you?
Peres, the Israeli foreign minister, a longtime Israeli leader in any number of governments, joining us from Jerusalem tonight, where it is a little bit after 11 o'clock, about 10 minutes after 11. Thank you, sir, for joining us. We are getting information now that one of the other buildings, Building 7 in the World Trade Center complex, is on fire and has either collapsed or is collapsing. And you, to be honest, can see these pictures a little bit more clearly than I. But building number 7, one of the buildings.
Okay. Let me just repeat to you what he said, what Aaron Brown, who's the anchor here, has said up to this point. We are getting information now that one of the other buildings, Building 7, in the World Trade Center complex, is on fire and has either collapsed or is collapsing. And to be honest, you can see these pictures a little bit more clearly than I can. Why is he saying that? Because he's staring at his monitor and the building hasn't collapsed. And Brown, and by the way, I would never claim Aaron Brown was in on this because he looks baffled the whole day. Well, that could be. I don't watch it enough to know. But in any case, Mr. Brown, says it's collapsed or it's collapsing, and you, to be honest, can see these pictures a little bit more clearly than I, because look what he's looking at. It's standing there. So now he does something that I find quite rare for a TV newsman. You see, because the actual World Trade Center is behind him. He's in New York, he's in Manhattan, he's giving this with the World Trade Center behind him. He can't believe his monitor. So he turns his back to the camera and looks at the actual World Trade Center. And guess what? It is still there. And in this case, his caption is a little bit softer than what he's saying. The caption says, Building 7 at World Trade Center on fire may collapse. Somehow Mr. Brown has gotten just a slightly different message than is given to the caption. But nonetheless, he has announced the collapse of World Trade 7 1 hour and 10 minutes before it came down. Now, that would be interesting enough in itself, but I find the whole CNN coverage of this quite fascinating. If I had announced falsely that a building had come down, I might apologize, I might explain, but at least I would flee from Building 7 for a while. We blew that one, and go on to other topics. On the contrary, for the next hour and 10 minutes, Building 7 seldom leaves the screen. I believe someone has told them, don't worry, folks, it's coming down. We get it on split screen, we get it in full screen, and throughout that time, the caption remains the same. Building 7, blah, 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 may collapse. Here it is. Here's an example. I thought I would just pick this frame as an example. Half an hour before the collapse, full shot by CNN of the building. The building itself hasn't changed as far as we can see. Building 7, blah, 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 may collapse. And this caption is something I would use as an example of normalizing the abnormal. Building 7 on fire may collapse. It's a little bit like saying McQueen hurts knee, may die. It looks normal. People look at that and they think, okay, he may collapse. But as we've already seen, these buildings don't collapse from fire. Anyway, the plot continues to thicken because look what happens when we get 4.5 minutes before the collapse. Look at the caption. Building 7 ablaze, poised to collapse. Suddenly, we know the damn thing's coming down, and it's coming down fast. And one last little change to confirm that, 1.5 minutes before it comes down, on verge of collapse. And it then does come down, and we get the confirming shot. Well, I don't think it's too much to say that people at CNN were told, first of all, that this building is coming down, keep your camera on it. And secondly, that they were updated and were told that the end is approaching. And they knew it at least 5 minutes before the end. And I gave you all this to make the point that we have a really quite amazing amount of detail in this foreknowledge of Building 7's collapse. They know the nature, they know how far the cloud's going to come, and they know quite precisely when it's going to come down. Therefore, the last criterion, that of detail, has been met, and we may now speak of foreknowledge of Building 7's collapse. The next thing I want to address very briefly with you is how the National Institute of Standards and Technology has dealt with this issue and how it has responded to us when we make these points. I have scoured the final report on World Trade 7 a couple of times, and the only statement I have found that addresses this at all is the following. The emergency responders quickly recognized that World Trade 7 had been damaged by the collapse of World Trade 1. As early as 11:30 a.m., FDNY, that is Fire Department of New York, recognized that there was no water coming out of the hydrant system to fight the fires that were visible. With the collapses of the towers fresh in their minds, there was concern that World Trade 7 might collapse. That's it, folks. All of the evidence that I've presented to you is simply omitted. No attempt to ask whether this is a vague concern or whether it's precise foreknowledge. The implication is it was a vague concern. We don't even know if it was a legitimate concern. It could be the firefighters were traumatized when the towers came down and therefore made the completely invalid conclusion that this utterly different building, injured in an utterly different way, would also collapse. They don't tell us. They leave it vague. It just isn't good enough to deal with these major anomalies. The only other instance I know of, although maybe some of you have found others, in which NIST has addressed foreknowledge, is when in August 25th, 2008, I had the opportunity on a radio station in Canada to debate Shyam Sundar, the lead investigator for the World Trade 7 study. And it was a fairly long debate. And one of the things I got to ask him was about foreknowledge. And his reply is as follows. I've edited it a little to make it shorter, but I have not changed the meaning. There was an engineer who was providing advice to city agencies on 9/11 about the condition of buildings, in particular Building 7. And it was his judgment that he was hearing creaking sounds, which was entirely appropriate and consistent with fires causing damage to connections and members. And he was hearing such sounds that would suggest that the building may come down. And he, of course, was observing the fires in the building as well. So it was based on that advice that the fire department decided around mid-afternoon, around 2:30 in the afternoon, to abandon fighting the fires in that building. So it is something, and this is the gist, this is what he's saying, he sums it up nicely. So it is something that people were expecting could happen based on what they were seeing and hearing. I have to hand it to Dr. Sundar. I mean, he's made the best possible case he could, really. He's made the whole thing vague, which is to NIST's advantage. He said there was an engineer. He doesn't even know who. And given that NIST apparently has the power to subpoena witnesses, it's peculiar that he wouldn't try and find out who this engineer was. He doesn't give us a specific time, though other sources place this engineer on the scene around noon. All we know from Sundar is that it's before 2:30. The engineer hears creaking in the building and sees fire in the building and concludes that it might collapse. Well, the point is, creaking could mean quite a number of things. And that's why this observation, creaking and so on, is not adequate to the task. Now, I think I've said enough by now to show you that actual foreknowledge existed, and that in both of these responses by NIST, the one about the firefighters at 11:30 and the one about the engineer, there is no acknowledgement that foreknowledge existed. Instead, it becomes a concern based on what people see and hear. And I'm telling you, that general vague concern does not explain how CNN knew 4.5 minutes in advance that it was coming down. It does not explain 100 firefighters standing around for hours waiting for it to come down, and so on and so on. They make their hypothesis work by ignoring the evidence. The last point I want to make on this particular issue is that when people try to explain this foreknowledge as natural and rational, and this applies even to NIST, they tend to revert to various vague hypotheses that existed before 2008 and before their own report. Their own report, and I think Kevin Ryan's going to say more about this in a minute, has a very particular collapse hypothesis, which is completely incompatible with foreknowledge. For example, the idea that the building was a raging inferno and that the steel was being weakened, and that's why it came down, they brush it aside. The fact that it took a structurally significant hit from the North Tower, they brush it aside. Why did it come down? Well, you'll hear more in detail later. I just want to say three things that characterize their final collapse hypothesis. First of all, it emphasizes the uniqueness of this event. Not just the first building to come down from fire, but that there's a whole series of unique events. That there was a long span beam, and there was a certain amount of fire that heated it up to a certain extent. And that beam was connected to this, which was connected to that. And the whole thing is unique and has never happened before. And I'm asking you how that uniqueness fits with foreknowledge that people had several hours before the event. It's impossible. It doesn't fit. People couldn't have known that was going to happen. Secondly, not only is it unique, there's a high degree of randomness in the NIST hypothesis. For example, you have fires burning, and there's 10 floors on fire, and then there's 6 floors, there's 2 floors. The fires wander. They end up at one point in the northeast corner. Well, that happens to be crucial to the hypothesis. If they didn't end up in that corner, the building wouldn't have come down, according to them. How could anyone have predicted they would end up in the northeast corner? Answer, they couldn't. Did the fires, in fact, reach the northeast corner by the time the engineer was on the scene? Nope. They weren't even there when the engineer made his prediction. So there is randomness does not go well with foreknowledge. Astronomers can tell you there will be a lunar eclipse next week because the movements of the heavenly bodies are very regular and well known. But weather prediction is much more difficult because there are many events, many of them random, that interact, and it's very difficult to have foreknowledge with weather prediction. And I'm telling you that NIST's 2008 hypothesis says that this was not like the heavenly bodies, this was more like weather prediction. Many random elements combining. And that makes foreknowledge, frankly, impossible. And finally, according to NIST's hypothesis, these crucial events in the building were invisible. It wasn't the outward raging fires. It was the heating of specific elements in the floors, which then led to this and that, and nobody could have seen that from outside. So talking about what people saw at 11:30 in the morning is not really all that relevant. My conclusion is that NIST's 2008 collapse hypothesis is incompatible with the knowledge, with the evidence of foreknowledge that we possess, and that NIST has repeatedly denied and tried to obfuscate, tried to blur that evidence in order to maintain its hypothesis. I further want to affirm, although I won't be able to have time to argue this in detail here, that I've looked at other hypotheses as well, the ones that existed before 2008, and the only collapse hypothesis that I have found that's compatible with this foreknowledge is the action-based hypothesis. People knew this building was coming down because somebody was going to bring it down, and that's where the knowledge came from. And that's why I say only the controlled demolition hypothesis is compatible with this evidence of foreknowledge. Now, there's one more stage in my talk today. I'm sure there are some of you, particularly those of you who are encountering this discussion for the first time, who are thinking, well, You know, that foreknowledge is certainly weird, and it doesn't seem to fit very well with the government hypothesis. But McQueen seems to be going a little too quickly to control demolition. You know, couldn't there be some other explanation? Well, first of all, you're going to be hearing from other speakers today, and they will make the case, different parts of the case, and they'll make it more comprehensive than I have done. I'm giving you one piece of the puzzle. However, I'm going to start you off on the next stage of our thinking about this by looking very briefly at three types of witness evidence. And I think when you've seen these witnesses, you'll realize that there are many reasons why we gravitate to the controlled demolition hypotheses. And I'm giving these in this talk because each one of them supports the claim I've been making that foreknowledge indicates controlled demolition. So we can get to these witnesses that I'm going to present quite briefly to you today by asking three questions. First of all, were there any authorities on the scene on 9/11 before the collapse of World Trade 7 who said that bringing the building down deliberately was an option, was being discussed on 9/11? In other words, if say, firefighters were standing around saying, well, maybe we'll have to bring it down, that would mean we would have no choice but to consider the controlled demolition as a possible hypothesis. And the second question that we would want to ask is, are there any insiders, anybody, are there people with inside knowledge who said after 9/11 that we did bring it down? That would be nice to know. And thirdly, are there any witnesses who claim to have experienced explosions in World Trade 7? And the answer to all three questions is yes. I will be going through them briefly because I don't want to go on too long today. We start with the first issue. Is there evidence that controlled demolition was being discussed as a possibility before this building came down? Now, this witness, Indira Singh, was a senior consultant for J.P. Morgan Chase, and on 9/11 was working as a voluntary emergency medical worker. She was interviewed by Bonnie Falconer in 2005 on Guns and Butter, and this little short excerpt, is from that.
All I can attest to is that by noon or 1 o'clock, they told us we had to move from that triage site up to Pace University, a little further away, because Building 7 was going to come down or being brought down.
Did they actually use the word brought down, and who was it that was telling you this?
In the fire department. The fire department, and they did use the word, we're going to have to bring it down.
That's a remarkable statement. So, question, is there any corroborating evidence? Has any other witness said the same thing? Yes. This next footage is live from MSNBC right after the collapse of World Trade 7. Fascinating clip.
All right, we're going to have to move this way. That cloud is coming this way.
Yeah. Ashley, get out of there. Leave the camera on, man, if you need to, and get out of there. What we've been fearing all afternoon has apparently happened. We were watching number 7 World Trade, which was part of the ancillary damage of the explosion and collapse of the other two. We've been talking all day about how fast these plumes of smoke move. You're watching one on the move right now that is building dust. Look at the wider shot on the left from across the river in New York. This was a 40-story building they've been watching all day. This is like watching the collapse of an active volcano. And the dust from it is not unlike that from a volcano. We are on the phone with New York Fire Department Lieutenant David Restuccio. Lieutenant, where are you right now?
I'm at the corner of Northmore Street and Greenwich Street.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes, sir.
And you guys knew this was coming all day?
We had been we had heard reports that the building was unstable and that it eventually would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own.
I'm going to assume you heard those last few words, but I'm going to read them again anyway. TV anchor, you guys knew this was coming all day. Isn't that remarkable? You knew this was coming all day. All day long, you've known this building is going to come down. That's foreknowledge again, and it shows that the news stations had gotten information of this sort. Restuccio gives a very careful reply. We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that eventually it would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own. In other words, if I could reword Restuccio's last statement, this building has just utterly and completely collapsed. I guess it's probably a gravity-driven collapse, but it might be controlled demolition, because that was discussed during the day. So we have two highly credible witnesses who say that this was discussed as an option during the day. We now move to our next question, and you've already seen Silverstein, but it won't hurt to see him again, of Silverstein Development Corporation that owned Building 7, and I think we need to turn up the sound for this.
Pelted by debris when the North Tower collapsed, 7 burned until late afternoon, allowing occupants to evacuate to safety.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. And I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Right. Many of you have already seen that clip, and perhaps it's not necessary for me to discuss it at length. It's not surprising that people took his comments about pulling to refer to removing, getting rid of, demolishing the building. Silverstein later said that all he had meant was that they should pull firefighters out of the building or of the area. Many people, including me, reject that explanation. However, we don't have time to get into the details of that debate here. Because we're talking about the kind of investigation that NIST did, let's just ask whether they had tough questions for Mr. Silverstein. And I believe it's Manny who already told us just how tough those questions were. They accepted immediately his explanation that he'd referred to pulling people out of the building. And when I think it was Laurie Van Auken asked Sundar directly if they had interviewed Silverstein, he basically said, we didn't interview him and we don't intend to. So much, my friends, for tough questions, and so much for a serious investigation of the collapse of World Trade 7. And I move on to my last witness. Were there any people who actually experienced explosions in World Trade 7? And there were several, but the most famous is Barry Jennings. Because my time is just about over, I'm going to show you only a very brief clip, so you'll see who Barry Jennings was on 9/11 itself. And then I'll explain why his testimony is important.
For the past couple of minutes, it has been clear from this space back on Chambers in that area. So now they're walking back toward the World Trade Center. And as we keep letting you hear the personal stories, the survivor stories of exactly what happened inside the World Trade Center when that first plane went in, and of course the collapses since then, we're going to bring more of those to you now. Barry Jennings, you're on the 8th floor. You work for the City Housing Department. Explain to me the moment of impact.
Well, me and Mr. Hess, the Corporation Council, were on the 23rd floor. I told him we got to get out of here. We started walking down the stairs. We made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Blew us back into the 8th floor. And I turned to Hesh. I said, this is it. We're dead. We're not going to make it out of here.
That's all I'm going to show. Barry Jennings at that time was deputy director of the Emergency Services Department of the New York City Housing Authority. Highly credible man, a very articulate man, who was interviewed many times subsequent to this. The gist of Barry Jennings' story is that he and Michael Hess, Corporation Counsel for the City of New York, went up to the 23rd floor of World Trade 7, which is the building he's talking about here. In other words, they went to the Office of Emergency Management, as they were supposed to do when there was an emergency in New York. He says they went up there very early. He thinks it was sometime just before or just after 9 o'clock in the morning. They got there and the place had already been abandoned, and someone on the phone told them to get the heck out of there as fast as they could, so they began running down the stairs to get out of the building. They made it to the 6th floor. Jennings says the 8th floor on this little clip, but he later clarifies, he said, no, we made it to the 6th floor when there was a big explosion, blew out the stairs, even blew out the landing he was standing on, so that he had to grab hold of the railing and pull himself up. They retreated to the 8th floor. They couldn't get down the stairs because they were blown out, and they were trapped there, and they thought they were going to die. They were saying their prayers. Hours later, well after the collapse of both towers, they were finally rescued by firefighters, and it was shortly after that that Mr. Jennings gave this little interview. Now, the gist of this is as follows. If he's right, there was at least one major, structurally significant explosion in the World Trade Center early in the morning, World Trade Center 7. I don't know whether that was an early and unsuccessful attempt to demolish the building, or whether it was the beginning stages of weakening the building so that it would come down later. I don't know. But that explosion did not exist, according to NIST. They are adamant that it did not exist. So what did they do to Mr. Jennings' testimony in order to deal with him? They changed two major things. First, they say Mr. Jennings did not perceive an explosion. We've heard from Bob earlier this morning how much NIST hates explosions and how much they hate anybody who refers to them. Some of you know I've now cataloged 155 eyewitnesses to explosions in the Twin Towers at the time they came down. I've published 118 of those. NIST waves them all away. People like you and me who perceived explosions, some of them were thrown 40 feet, some of them talk about seeing them tearing the buildings apart, they're all wrong. They're all wrong. What kind of a governmental system has been created where ordinary people can not only think, we can apparently not even use our five senses? We're all wrong. So it wasn't difficult in that light to dismiss Mr. Jennings and say he was wrong. He didn't perceive an explosion. What did he perceive then? Debris. Debris from the North Tower falling on World Trade 7 confused him, and he thought it was an explosion. And that requires them to say that Mr. Jennings was also off by roughly an hour in his time. He thought he experienced that somewhere around 9:30, but actually it was when World Trade 1 came down at 10:30. Well, all I'm going to say is this. Mr. Jennings cannot defend himself or speak up for himself because he died on August 19th, 2 days before the announcement of the final NIST report. We don't know why or how he died, but he died. And in the meantime, until I see evidence to the contrary, I am going to believe his testimony. I'm going to accept that he perceived what he said he perceived at roughly the time that he said he perceived it. And that means there were explosions in World Trade 7. My friends, my time is up, and I am going to sum up my talk as I end with the five major points. There was widespread foreknowledge of World Trade 7's collapse. This foreknowledge is incompatible with NIST's collapse hypothesis. Therefore, NIST's hypothesis is wrong. The controlled demolition hypothesis is compatible with the evidence of foreknowledge. There is also witness evidence that supports the controlled demolition hypothesis. Thank you very much for your patience.